Let me say a word about the Panama Free Trade Agreement. Now, Panama is a very small country. Its entire annual economic output is only $26.7 billion a year, or about 0.2% of the American economy. So I think no one is going to legitimately stand up here and say that trading with such a small country is going to significantly increase American jobs. Then why would we? Why would we be considering a trade agreement with Panama? What's going on there? Well, it turns out, Mr. President, that Panama is a world leader when it comes to allowing wealthy Americans and large corporations to evade U.S. taxes by stashing their cash in offshore tax havens. And the Panama Free Trade Agreement would make this bad situation much worse.
That was Bernie Sanders on the Senate floor in 2011. And the Mr. President that he was referring to in that clip at that time was President Obama. So we're heading into the holiday season. Christmas time's just around the corner. Sure enough, soon enough, we're going to be filling ourselves with turkey, tearing open gifts, and engaging in a lot of those things that we do every year. One of them being recognizing all of a sudden that we have homeless people. There are homeless people all over the streets. We don't tend to notice them the rest of the time, and I suppose we tend to think of it as long-term camping. When it's summer outside, can't be that bad. It's summer, boy. Some of us even decide to sleep outside in the summertime because, man, it's nice outside during the summer. And then the cold and the rain and the snow and the freezing and all the rest comes and we go, man, what about the folks on the streets? You know what we should do for Thanksgiving and Christmas, but not for the other 360 days of the year? We should go ahead and go down to our a local shelter or a St. Vincent de Paul or Union Gospel Mission, and we should donate our time, and we should give money to the homeless or serve food to the homeless. Feed them a Christmas dinner. Feed them a Thanksgiving dinner, because, my God, it's the only time of year those people clearly need any help. I don't mean to complain about how during the holidays we seem to find it in our hearts to notice these largely unseen and forgotten people. But we don't really recognize them any other time, and it's a problem all the time. So in downtown Portland right now, there's a number of businesses that are either moving or considering moving because of how bad the homeless problem has gotten. Portland has the slogan for the city. Its slogan is, "The City That Works." And I remember seeing that when I first moved here, and I go, my God, I can't wait to spend some time here and see how a city works. And the problem that Portland has with homeless people is not unique to Portland. It's really everywhere and anywhere where you've got a lot of very wealthy people. And Portland has a good working class, but they also have a lot of wealthy people. And with the real estate prices in California, we've seen more and more of those folks moving up here. But the homeless issue is one that we don't think a lot about. We don't talk a lot about. I discuss it a lot on this program, and it's an incredibly hard thing for me to see. The problem with helping the homeless in our society, our capitalistic society, lies in that word, capitalistic. We don't see a need to take care of it because, for one, it's not us. I mean, our Ayn Rand, unregulated, laissez-faire system almost requires that we really only pay attention to ourselves. And if we pay attention to other people, we should be paying attention to only the super wealthy. We'll get to that in just a minute. There's not going to be a free market solution for this. See, whenever we have a problem, you'll hear conservatives argue, we need a free market solution. Free markets, free people. Free market solution for this. We need a free market solution. There's no free market solution for the homeless problem because there is no profit in helping the homeless. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for being here on the Fire You Can't Put Out, episode number 229. My name is Melvin, broadcasting live from Portland, Oregon. And I want to thank you so much for being here. So today I want to start by talking about the Paradise Papers. Now, I mentioned that, yeah, we should be paying attention to what's happening with the homeless. And of course, we will. But it's not enough to simply recognize that they're there, or maybe even recognize some of the programs that are taking care of them. It's a large systemic problem, and it's a problem that stems from inequality. See, there's always going to be someone in society that's not going to be able to take care of themselves. So the question for us is how we, as a society, and we are, how we are going to take care of those people. But the fight that we're having right now is over taxes. Should rich people get massive tax cuts? And of course, the answer is yes. And when they get those massive tax cuts, exactly how massive should those tax cuts be? Most of us, you know what? This bad news, I'm going to tune it out. I don't want to hear this, Melvin. I don't want to hear this. I don't care. I'm not rich. It's not going to affect me. It's their money. Friggin' let them have it, Melvin. Who cares? And I suppose you can make that argument. I'd love to hear it. I'd love you to make it to my face. But the reason you should care about this is because the level of inequality that comes from hoarding money, and that's exactly what it is, hoarding money. If this were cats or newspapers, I always use that example. If this were cats or newspapers, we'd be hauling somebody out of their home, inviting in a camera crew, and shoveling out cats and newspapers, you know, with a big dumpster outside and making a big spectacle out of it. And, oh my God, you've been hoarding all your life. Jeez, you're so terrible. We got to get you help. You've been hoarding, da-da-da-da-da. But what we do when it's money is we go, eh, that's just the way it is. So how much is enough? The larger issue right now that nobody's talking about, the pitchforks and the torches, we should be in the streets right now about this issue, but we're not. And the one I'm referring to is the Paradise Papers. You may remember a year or so ago, maybe about 2 years ago, there was a story that broke about the Panama Papers. What Bernie Sanders was just talking about there. Why all of a sudden this interest in Panama? Well, what the Panama Papers told us is that there were all these offshore accounts, all of these large multinational corporations, largely in America. You'll hear about the Paradise Papers, which expands it to the entire world. But we learned about them hiding their money. So why is that important? We belong to a society, which is to say that we are all a part of it. We all contribute to it. We all benefit from it. And we're all trying to get enough so that we can be happy and so that we can be comfortable. Well, at least that's what I'm trying to do. Most folks that I know, we talk about being rich and wanting to be rich, but I don't think most of us are honestly really, really trying to become rich. I think most of us are just trying to become comfortable and happy. And that's an admirable thing. There's nothing wrong with that. But for certain segments of our economy, it's not enough to just be comfortable, and it's definitely not enough to be rich or have more money than God or pick your slogan here. They have to have all the damn money, and when they have all the damn money, it's still not enough. The Guardian has been covering this, and there are hundreds, if not thousands, of journalists on this right now. So, quoting from The Guardian, and the entire first half of today's show is going to be all articles from The Guardian. That's just in case I forget to mention any of them. When I'm quoting them, I always like to mention the author and the source. So this from Nick Hopkins and Helena Bengston over at The Guardian. What are the Paradise Papers? The name refers to a leak of 13.4 million files, more than a terabyte of files. When you have computer files, videos are probably the largest files. Music is probably the second largest. And then photos are probably the third largest. And the smallest file, when you're trying to store something onto a hard drive or a thumb drive, are documents. They don't really take up that much room. But there are so many files from the Paradise Papers that it came to more than a terabyte. So, and it relates to the leak. It relates to a law firm called Appleby. Last year, the fiduciary, which is Appleby, no relation to the restaurant, was the subject of a management buyout and is now called Estera. There are also details from 19 corporate registries maintained by governments in secret jurisdictions: Antigua, Barbuda, Aruba, the Bahamas, Barbados, Bermuda, the Cayman Islands, the Cook Islands, Dominica, Grenada, Lebanon, Malta, the Marshall Islands, St. Kitts, Nevis, St. Lucia, St. Vincent, Samoa, Trinidad, Tobago, and Vanuatu. Mostly, if not all, islands. None of these really are a part, at least contiguously, a part of a country. The papers cover the period from 1950 to 2016, though on this show, I'm largely concerned. I would like to see a more narrow, just from 1980 until now. Because I believe, at least in America, that's when most of this idea, this laissez-faire, screw everybody that's not me, was released with the Ronald Reagan presidency. And we've been trying to think like that ever since. And he goes, hey, I just want everybody to be rich. Everybody can't be rich. Somebody's going to not be rich because that's not the way it works. There's not enough money in the world, as the old saying goes. There's enough to fill every man's need, but not to fill every man's greed. So how many media organizations are looking at the data? The Guardian is one of 96 media partners on the subject. A total of 381 journalists from 67 countries have been analyzing the material, and it's laborious. Who got the documents and how? How did we come to know about these documents, which are all about all this offshored money? The leaks were obtained by the German newspaper, I'm going to screw up this name, forgive me, Süddeutsche Zeitung, which also received the Panama Papers the previous year. The newspaper shared the material with the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, a U.S.-based organization that coordinated the global collaboration. The newspaper has not and will not discuss issues around sourcing, like a good journalistic record should do. Do the Paradise Papers focus on companies or individuals? Both. They are united by one thing: money. Some of the world's biggest multinationals featured in the leak include Apple, Nike, and Facebook, as well as some of the richest people in the world, from the Queen to Bono. And I want to say something about Bono. So this entire thing is about people hiding their money. One of the things that incredibly wealthy people do, especially if they're famous, they become philanthropists. They say, I have been blessed with such great wealth that I would like to give some of my wealth to the little people. And every so often, they'll kick some of that money down. Phil Knight, the head of Nike, and by the way, I hate Nike. I'm going to be dumping on him today. Phil Knight, the head of Nike, always does this. He says, I'm going to give money to this charity and to that charity and money to fight cancer, and I'm going to be helping the poor people. And this is an illusion, because if these companies, at least the ones that manufacture, so not necessarily the tech companies, but the manufacturing companies like Nike benefit from slave labor, benefit from exploiting the people in these incredibly poor countries, and then they become super duper rich off of their backs. But here in America, we recognize them as the titans of industry, the masters of the universe. And when they kick down some money to the little people to help with cancer or hungry, then we go, oh my God, they're such great humanitarians. But maybe they wouldn't have ended up with such blinding wealth if they weren't exploiting poor people in the first place. Bono is one of these guys. He gives money. And I don't hate, you know, Bono or U2, although I'm getting sour on Bono now. He's one of these guys that has this global consciousness. He talks about all these issues around the world with hunger and poverty and Amy and all the rest, right? And he gives money to these causes. Now, he himself hasn't benefited from enslaving people. But if he's hiding millions or billions, considering this is U2, if he's hiding millions or billions of dollars in offshore accounts to avoid paying taxes would help lift a whole bunch of those people out of poverty, Bono. And I'm sorry to pick on him. I'm just making an example of him. I know he's not the only one that does this. I mentioned Phil Knight a minute ago. But if you really care about the inequality in the world, why the hell are you hiding your money offshore? So, what do the documents show? The files show that the offshore empire is bigger and more complicated than most people thought. And even companies such as Appleby, which prides itself on being the standard bearer in the field, have fallen foul of the regulators that try to police this particular industry. The files set out the myriad of ways in which companies and individuals can avoid tax using artificial structures. These schemes are legal if run correctly, but many appear not to be, and politicians around the world are beginning to ask if they should be banned and if they are fair. So here's the other thing about legal. We decide if something is legal. Not if it's moral. We decide if something is legal. And yeah, a lot of what these companies are doing are legal. When reached out to for a comment, Appleby would not reach back. And then when they did, they said, what is happening here is above board and perfectly legal. Sure, if you set up a post office box on an island, say Panama or Barbados or Samoa, you set up and you say that that is where your company is based. And there's no storefront. There's no factory. There's no employees where that post office box is on a tiny island. See, there's a post office, and I forget which one of these islands it is. I've been reading so much about this. But suffice it to say, there's one island with hundreds of companies that have this one address on one of these tiny islands. And the building itself, probably not much bigger than your house. And I'm assuming you don't live in a freaking mansion. And inside there are all of these well-known companies from around the world based inside essentially this one post office. And the reason why is because they say that is their company address. By having that as their company address, they have all the – and then there's other systems they have for moving the money around the world so that they can actually collect it. So some of the key revelations from the not just the Panama Papers – but from the Paradise Papers, go like this. Millions of pounds. The Queen is involved in this. Millions of pounds from the Queen's private estate has been invested in a Cayman Islands fund. Prince Charles is in this too. Extensive offshore dealings by Donald Trump's cabinet members, advisors, and donors, including substantial payments from a firm co-owned by Vladimir Putin's son-in-law to the shipping group of the U.S. Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross. A bunch of people that work for Trump have their names in the Paradise Papers. Twitter and Facebook receive hundreds of millions of dollars in investments that can be traced back to a Russian state financial institution. The tax-avoiding Cayman Islands Trust, managed by the Canadian Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau's chief money man. Justin Trudeau. I remember after Trump became president, it ended up on the cover of the Rolling Stone. Not Trump, but Justin Trudeau. And the headline, if I'm remembering it correctly, I've got the picture here in the studio. I can't find it right now. But the headline said, why can't Justin Trudeau be our president instead? Why can't Justin Trudeau be our president? Well, because he is also involved in this. He is also keeping money offshore. Oxford and Cambridge, top U.S. universities invested offshore, with some of the money going into fossil fuel industries. Prominent Brexit campaigners have put money offshore. The Duke of Westminster pumped millions into secretive offshore firms. A tax haven lobby boasted of superb penetration at the top of the UK government before the G8 summit. And that was expected to bring in greater offshore transparency. Turns out they're invested in these offshore accounts as well. Seven major Republican donors are keeping money in tax havens. The Democrats, a top Democratic donor, built up a vast $8 billion private wealth fund in Bermuda. Harvey Weinstein, Shakira, Robert Kraft, the New England Patriots owner, on and on and on and on. This is deep and it's everywhere. And all of these names are in the paper that these hundreds of journalists are going through right now. You know, reading 8, 10, 12 hours a day right now, going through all this stuff. And it's not on the evening news. Trump has two things going on right now. He's got the Russia investigation and the fact that a whole bunch of the members of his cabinet are named in the Paradise Papers. And so what did he do on Friday? He decided to name Kim Jong-un as a state sponsor of terror. Why? Because he needs you to not look at the Russia investigation. And he definitely needs you to not look at the Paradise Papers.
Here's how the law firm works. Mossack Fonseca registers companies in tax havens on an industrial scale. Many companies exist on paper only, with no office and no employees. One of the big selling points is anonymity. Clients can pay Mossack Fonseca extra to provide front people, known as nominees, so they can act as shareholders, directors, or even the owners of your company.
It's like a parallel universe where people hide their money. They hide the money from the state, and that's essentially that's taxes that we miss. That's taxes that could be used for building schools or kindergartens.
Mossack Fonseca has registered over 200,000 companies, trusts, and foundations in secretive jurisdictions around the world, roughly half in the British Virgin Islands, and the rest split between countries including Panama, the Seychelles, the Bahamas, and Samoa.
We're shining a bright white light on this because it needs to be. This is what should be in your news media feed right now, your social media feed. This is what should be on your evening news, both local and national. This is what should be discussed on CNN and Fox News right now. This is what should be discussed on MSNBC right now. But it's not. And why is it not? With respect to our local media, I can tell you that the reason it's not being discussed on our local media, and in Portland, they're not. The journalists that we have working at some of our radio and newspapers and television generally aren't that bad. Around here, there's a lot of progressive individuals, and they demand more from their news. They demand more from their journalists. But I think the reason this isn't being covered even locally is because Nike is an effing darling around here. Oh, everybody loves Nike. Everybody just loves Phil Knight and Prefontaine. All right, Prefontaine ain't a part of this. But Nike is dirty and awful. Using slave labor. Out in Beaverton, they're expanding right now. And what's happening in Beaverton, which Beaverton is right next to Portland. The expansion that's in Beaverton, I go out there and I look around and they're not bringing manufacturing home. That's not what's happening. They have an entire campus, and they're expanding that campus. Why? Because more marketing. Nike is a marketing company. Nike doesn't make anything. Nike does not have an excellent product. Nike does not believe da 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 da. They are a marketing company. That's it. Trump didn't become president because people believed that he really was going to do good as president. Or if they did, they certainly realized that now that that's not going to happen. He doesn't really care about, you know, poor people and gay people and all these people he claimed to care about. But he was great at marketing and still is. The Paradise Papers should be a story, but he's shifting everyone away from it. But then again, so is the rest of the media. So I want to focus just a little bit on Nike. Everybody knows Nike. And I did not know until I moved to this area that Nike was in the Portland, Oregon area. So here's for one example, the way Nike's doing it. Quoting here from a story by Nick Hopkins and Simon Bowers, also over at The Guardian. So Nike shoes are made in countries such as Vietnam and Indonesia. From there, they are shipped to the company's warehouse in Belgium. It's called the Lakedal Logistics Hub, and it's a sneaker storeroom of a huge scale, okay? When shops need shoes, they come from there. Buy a pair of Nikes in, say, London, and then one would expect the cash to go to the company's main British subsidiary, Nike UK Limited. That would make sense, but this is not what happens. The money from those sales flows out of the UK and into the Netherlands. Now, the Netherlands is significant. In particular, two companies at the heart of Nike's Dutch operations. They pay some tax on the near $8 billion of revenue that they receive from Nike sales across Europe, Middle East, and Africa. However, from 2005 to 2014, Nike was able to shift vast sums of money out of the Netherlands and Bermuda, which is an offshore tax haven with zero tax. Zero. Nike did this through a Bermudan subsidiary, Nike International Limited, which held the company's intellectual property rights for its sneaker brands, the crown jewels of the Nike empire, even though this subsidiary did not appear to have any staff or offices in Bermuda. It charged large trademark royalty fees each year to Nike's European headquarters for selling its shoes. The fees allowed Nike to legally shift profits away from Nike, from Europe to Nike International Limited. So they make them in one place, and they're shipped off to wherever the shoes are needed. And then the monies that is collected goes to this offshore account. I'm sorry, all of this stuff is terribly, terribly convoluted. And then Nike can say that, hey, those aren't our shoes that are being sold. Yeah, we're Nike, we're a shoe company. Those aren't our shoes that are being sold. That's our name that's being sold. Almost like it's just being licensed. In 2014, Nike had to think again with the deal from the Netherlands due to expire. The company came up with a new plan, again with the agreement of Dutch authorities. This involved moving the company's intellectual property from Nike International Limited in Bermuda to yet another subsidiary, Nike Innovate CV. This entity is not based in Bermuda. It is actually based elsewhere. So how does it work? Now we move on to what is known as the CV model. Please stick with me. This is important. The CV model allows Nike to innovate to avoid paying local taxes in the Netherlands. Nike Innovate is not being taxed anywhere else either. Nike is not only the only multinational to use the CV model. Many of the U.S. largest multinationals use similar subsidiaries. So, Nike Innovate CV is a treasure indeed. It is seemingly beyond the reach of Dutch tax authorities, and it is also out of the range of the U.S. tax man. Even though Nike is a U.S. registered company with headquarters in Portland, Oregon, more specifically Beaverton, Nike Innovate does not seem to have tax residency anywhere in the world, and as such, pays no tax. The CV model and the one that preceded it in Bermuda appear to have helped Nike substantially reduce its global tax rate. Nike did this all with the help of smart lawyers, complex laws, and compliant governments. When Nike was asked about these arrangements, it said, as you would expect, Nike fully complies with tax regulations and we rigorously ensure our tax filings are fully aligned with how we run our business. The investments we make, the jobs we create, blah, 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 blah. But Nike and other multinationals are under pressure. The Organization for Economic Operation and Development has been trying to shut down the Dutch CV model, known in the trade as reverse hybrid mismatch, and it will be phased out under the EU's anti-tax avoidance directive. Nike may have to find a new way of funneling its money by 2021 or they're going to have to pay taxes. And this is the long, convoluted process that Nike goes through to not pay taxes. Nike is supposedly a U.S. company, certainly recognized as a U.S. brand. And they're here in our country, and then they go into other countries. And they use the court system for contract enforcement. They, of course, use the local resources. They, of course, use the local people. They, of course, get these kickbacks from the government and any and all the rest. And they get all of this stuff from all these countries, and they amass this massive, massive wealth. Right. And then, of course, they've got these $200, $300, $400 shoes that cost them pennies to make all around the world. And they get this massive, massive wealth, and they take and they take and they take and they take from these countries. And we're so concerned. We're so concerned about welfare. We're so concerned about poor people being on welfare. When it comes to these folks, we're totally cool with these folks.
American taxpayer is paying for the food stamps and Medicaid that many Walmart employees need because their wages are too low. Now, it is a little bit nuts to my mind when the middle class of this country has to subsidize the employees of the wealthiest family in this country.
Bernie Sanders is, of course, referring to Walmart in that particular clip. They get more of this corporate welfare than anybody. Their store, when it first started, it was Sam Walton's thing, you know, made in America, an American company, right? But as they got bigger and they expanded, and then, of course, he passed, I don't think you can find anything in a Walmart store that is made in America. They, too, wildly benefit from hiding their tax dollars and from slave wages. It's both the slave wages involved in the manufacturing of the product and the slave wages involved if you work at their store. It's no secret that when you sign up to work at most Walmarts, as part of your orientation, they tell you how to sign up for welfare benefits in your local jurisdiction.
One of the country's biggest banks, Wells Fargo, busted for creating millions of phony bank accounts to get fees for doing that and moving people's money around and putting it into other accounts that they didn't know about. We're talking about 5,300 employees. Some of these are managers who were essentially creating ghost accounts. This company and the people who worked for it, who got these incentives, issued debit cards and PIN numbers without the customer's knowledge. They also had people make fake emails.
I fear that especially here in America, if not around the world, we've gotten too used to corporate malfeasance. We go, by God, this is just the way it is, and we just have to deal with it. These guys can steal from us, and these guys can lie to us and fleece us and loot us. And Melvin, we can't do anything about it. You know, look. Let's say the Panama Papers become something. Let's say they start covering it on MSNBC and on Fox News and CNN. Let's say that it starts getting. Let's say, which it probably won't be, because I'm sure that people that either work or head up any of those news organizations also have money in offshore accounts, and their names are also in the Paradise Papers. And they go, but if it becomes a story and people do find out about it, Melvin, I'm pretty sure they're still not going to care because, hey, corporations get away with this stuff all the time.
These guys at Wells Fargo, what they did is an outrage. How many of them are going to go to jail?
Zero.
Well, there you go. But you smoke marijuana in this country, you're going to get a criminal record. That's pretty crazy stuff.
But we can do something, and we should do something, regardless of not whether this ends up in any sort of a conviction or an indictment, because we can't simply throw our hands up and just let this stuff happen. I understand that since Trump has become president, we're watching ourselves get screwed, and we're overloaded with news all the time, and we almost can't handle it. We just want to check out. I'm pretty sure with Thanksgiving coming up, most folks are going to want to check out, and I don't blame you for doing so. But you can't stay checked out, because if you do, this stuff is just going to keep happening, and it's just going to get more and more egregious. And even though it may not be personally affecting you right now, I promise you that at some point, it will.
Do you know how much the value of your stock went up while this scam was going on?
It's all of my compensation is in our public.
Do filing. You know how much it was?
It's all in the public filing.
Oh, you're right. It is all in the public records because I looked it up. While this scam was going on, you personally held an average of 6.75 million shares of Wells stock. The share price during this time period went up by about $30, which comes out to more than $200 million in gains, all for you personally. Now, here's what really gets me about this, Mr. Stump. If one of your tellers took a handful of $20 bills out of the cash drawer, they'd probably be looking at criminal charges for theft. They could end up in prison. But you squeezed your employees to the breaking point so they would cheat customers and you could drive up the value of your stock and put hundreds of millions of dollars in your own pocket. And when it all blew up, you kept your job, you kept your multi-million dollar bonuses, and you went on television to blame thousands of $12 an hour employees who were just trying to meet cross-sell quotas that made you rich. This is about accountability. You should resign. You should give back the money that you took while this scam was going on, and you should be criminally investigated by both the Department of Justice and the Securities and Exchange Commission.
And there is, of course, the chance that they might just not only get away with this, but might actually benefit from this. Might even find a way to blame this on a bunch of low-level employees we still have to fight. This kind of thing cannot continue to go on. I don't complain about these particular things because I like to complain. Truth be told, I don't. I would really, really, really like to see a better country. I would like to see a country where we care about homeless people. I would like to see a country where we look after one another. I'd like to see a country where we are concerned about inequality and where we realize that something, even something as widespread as racism, has nothing to do with race and everything to do with economics. I know how great this country can be, and that's why I'm concerned. Because I have always seen this, despite living through the Reagan era and the George W. Bush era and now the Trump era. I know that America can be that place where people come up from nothing. I came up from nothing. And I'm not rich and famous, but I'm doing great. I'm very comfortable and I'm very happy.
My dad came to this country at the age of 17 from Poland. I didn't have any money, couldn't speak English. He died pretty young, and I think it would have been beyond his wildest dreams to see his son up here on the stage today running for president. I love this country, and my dad loved this country, and he was the most proud American because of what it gave him in terms of raising his family, even though we never had much money. But today in America, we are the only major country on earth that doesn't guarantee health care to all people, that doesn't guarantee paid family and medical leave. We have the highest rate of childhood poverty of almost any major country on earth. We are seeing millions of families unable to send their kids to college in the United States of America. I'm running for president because I believe it is just too late for establishment politics and establishment economics. I do believe we need a political revolution where millions of people stand up and say loudly and clearly that our government belongs to all of us and not just a handful of wealthy campaign contributors. Thank you all.
I know that we can do better than this because I'm proof. It happened for me. And I learned about all these stories, especially post-World War II. You know, where folks got on the GI Bill and they got into the middle class and they bought a home. And what I hear now for millennials is that most of them, and we joke about this, most of them will never know home ownership because of our system. And so this dream, this middle class dream, is moving away from too many people. But there are folks at the top that are getting insanely rich, and they believe that they don't have to pay into the same system that they benefit from. It isn't just us that gets welfare or benefits from society and roads and bridges and police and fire and contract enforcement. They benefit too. But the big difference is that they would like us to foot the bill while they get all the benefits. I have seen this country be great. Honestly great. Not Trump great. Honestly great. And that's what I want. And that's why I bring this up. These guys have to pay their taxes. They don't get to do this. They don't get to benefit from the society and pay nothing into it. Because it is not just us. It's a society. And we're all in this together.
State House Republicans in Indiana are embracing the term user fee when describing their proposal to increase the amount of money Indiana motorists pay for gasoline and vehicle registrations. But minority Democrats say, make no mistake, the Republican plan to raise new money for infrastructure projects is simply a tax increase. During a Tuesday committee hearing at the State House, it was a point they made repeatedly. Republicans say their plan makes sense. The state's infrastructure is crumbling. People who drive more should pay more. They want to increase the state's gas tax by 10 cents and impose a $15 registration fee. Democrats say the proposal continues a GOP trend of recent years and shifts the tax burden away from the wealthy and onto the middle and working classes.
Jamie Herrera Butler, who is the representative for Southwest Washington. I say Portland, Oregon, but I really support Portland, Oregon and Vancouver, Washington. They're on opposite sides of the water, but they're one and the same. So Jamie Herrera Butler is my representative. She says she represents Southwest Washington. Of course, she doesn't, because she just voted for this gigantic tax cut for millionaires and billionaires. And she sent out a Facebook message and a tweet, and she says, I did this for you because I'm looking out for you and because I want to help you. Jamie, please stop trying to help me. You're failing, and it's awful. But there she is. And she's pushing this idea. Well, I think what a lot of folks don't understand when they see ads on television, especially ads that are clearly designed to change their minds, it costs money to put ads on TV. I'm very familiar with advertising now, more than I've ever been, because I am paying for advertising for my small business. And advertising rates are fairly expensive. You can get something online for one price. You can get something on the radio for a little bit higher price. You can get something on TV for an even higher price. I mean, and so to put something on television, especially during something that's really popular, it can make your ad incredibly expensive. And there's these ads running in prime time, which is probably the most expensive time to run an ad. It's in prime time. Those ads are not cheap. And there are ads running right now where folks are talking about the GOP tax plan is going to save us $2,000, $3,000, $4,000. Can I get an amen? But what you don't seem to realize is it costs money to put those on TV. So who's paying the money to put those on TV? And is somebody just opening their big fat wallet out of the goodness of their big fat heart because they just care so much about you? No, they don't. The reason those ads are running is because it's part of the con. It's part of the long con. See, as we talked about in the previous segment, rich people, well, they're rich. They're richer than ever. And they're getting richer. And enough is never enough. A lot of them are never going to be rich enough. We're not talking about the patriotic millionaires. That's a good group. But there's a lot of wealthy people. For them, being wealthy is simply not enough. They need more money. They're never going to have enough. Hoarding. They need more money. And so they're opening their wallets right now to pay for those ads because it's an investment. They know what's going to happen with that money. They know that those tax breaks are for them. They know that they're going to directly benefit from the tax cuts. And so they are selling to you that they need those tax, those tax cuts are for you. It's not for them. Yeah, they're spending money, but they're really just for you. Let's talk about billionaires for just a second. So you have $1 billion invested. The money that you would receive back on a daily basis from your investment. And this is getting back a daily rate of 0.1%, 0.01%. If you invested $1 billion, or 1,000 million, you would get back $1 million a day. Just investing it, $1 million a day. Now, I understand for some of the wealthiest people in the world, that's not enough money. My God, Melvin, they're going to have to go on welfare. They're going to be in rags and tatters. They can't survive on that kind of money. You have $1 billion and it's simply invested. You get back $1 million a day because you've got so much money invested. I mean, that's just so clearly what these fine folks need is more money. So here comes the GOP tax bill, which gets rid of the tax break for teachers to buy supplies for their students. And a lot of teachers do this, unfortunately, because they have to. They already don't make enough money, and then they have to spend money on their classrooms. But they get to write off about $250 of that at the end of the year. The GOP would like to get rid of that, but they would really also like to bring in a tax cut for corporate jets. You can write off your so you don't get your $250 back for buying supplies to your classroom, but your private jet, you can write that off. So clearly that one's written in there for us. They also get rid of the home mortgage deduction. And what it's looking like now is potentially going to come out of the Senate is a tax bill that raises taxes on everybody on the bottom tier. Now, wait a minute. I was told that we were all going to get this massive tax break. Right? Everybody's going to get $2,000, $3,000, $4,000 back every year. Hardworking taxpayer, all money for you. But it looks like the bill that's going to be coming out of the Senate is actually going to raise taxes on people that make less than $75,000 a year, as well as get rid of all these itemized deductions that we get. Now, wait a minute. Where's the middle class tax cut we were told about? And why is this bill all of a sudden going sideways? And by the way, why is it so damn important? And I think a lot of people are beginning to realize the con now, and the very, very long con. This tax bill, and we don't know what the final Senate version is going to look like yet, but this tax bill looks, it's incredibly unpopular. Chris Warsaw, a political scientist from George Washington University, recently put together a graph, and you can find this over at the Washington Post and Axios, and any number of sites have covered this. He put it out in a tweet, but it's become an actual news story. And he points out how deeply unpopular it was. The Clinton health care plan, which did not pass in 93, had just over 40% approval. The assault weapon ban has over 80% approval. The Brady bill has almost a 90% approval. The Bush tax cuts had over a 50% approval. But none of these things happened despite how unpopular they are. Then there's the GOP tax reform bill, somewhere between 20 and 30%, which isn't very high. But my God, they're pushing this thing, and they're pushing it hard. You know, the stimulus bill enjoys over 50%. The Dodd-Frank bill, almost 60%. The Affordable Care Act, about 50%. Expanding minimum wage, over 80%. Those are all things, if Congress really wants to do something for us, those are all things that Congress can do. So why is not Congress doing them? Why are they pushing this incredibly toxic tax bill that nobody wants? Well, it's because it's a time bomb. And it goes like this. Bruce Bartlett wrote an article for The Guardian. Bruce Bartlett used to work for both the Reagan and George Bush administration. The George H.W. Bush administration. By the time George W. Bush became president, he didn't believe in his own tax ideas anymore. Bruce Bartlett is one of these guys that's came over from the dark side. He's on the good side now. But he worked for the Reagan administration, and he helped push the idea of trickle-down economics. In recent years, he's written any number of articles, as well as a book about how he was dead wrong about trickle-down economics and how we should not be pushing for it anymore. And he wrote an article recently talking about the chess game that the GOP is playing. Quoting here from the article, the answer about why they're pushing this tax cut at breakneck speed is precisely because they know that they're going to lose next year, and they're going to lose in 2020, but they can get back into power by 2024. The tax cut, once enacted, will bind the hands of Democrats for years to come because of the 60-vote rule that is in the Senate, focusing them to essentially follow a Republican agenda of deficit reduction and prevent any positive Democratic program from getting through. The result will be a steady erosion of support for Democrats that will put Republicans back into power. So this goes back to the two Santa Claus theory. When the Republicans are in power, we don't talk about deficits anymore. Deficits are just fine. Adding $1.5 trillion to the deficit after screaming about the deficit for the last 8 years, that's completely fine. But when the Democrats get back into power, oh my God, look at the deficit. So this is the two Santa Claus theory. The Republicans come in and they spend like crazy. You know, the thing they accuse Democrats of doing. And then when the Democrats get in, they force them to shoot Santa Claus. Blam! Because during the 60s, and I forget who came up with this, I think it was Jude Wininski. He said, the Democrats always seem to win. And the reason why is because they're seen as the party of Santa Claus. They're the party that gives people stuff, healthcare, Social Security, safe food standards, roads and bridges, things of that nature. They're always giving stuff to people. So the Republicans need to be seen as the party of Santa Claus, and the Democrats need to be seen as the party that shoots Santa Claus when they get into power. So he came up with what's known as the two Santa Claus theory. And so that's what you see in practice right now. So when Obama was in power, we have to stop spending. We have to have sequestration. We have to have automatic cuts. No. We can't spend any money. Government spends so much money. Government's so huge. We can't spend. But now the Republicans are in power. And deficits don't matter. Not school deficits don't matter. Dick Cheney said it himself during the George W. Bush administration. Deficits do not matter. And they spent like crazy. They spent on the wars. They spent on tax cuts. And here it comes again. So now they're talking about pushing this gigantic tax cut through because they know that they are now the party of Roy Moore and Donald Trump. And on the heels of the election 2 weeks ago, they know it's a pretty solid chance they're going to lose in the next election. So push this tax cut through. And the increases on the lower class come in slowly. 2, 3, 4, I think after like 5 years, somewhere between 4 and 5 years, they're fully implemented. So right, just in time for the next presidential election. After the midterms, just in time for the next presidential election. And then people are going to look at these and they're going to go, oh my God, look at what the Democrats did. All the while, it'll be a pretty solid chance that the Democrats have been trying to reverse this tax policy, but they can't because of the 60-vote rule that exists in the Senate. So the Republicans know that if they pass this, and they pass this right now, that the Democrats will get all of the blame for this once the Republicans are out of power. And after the Republicans lose in 2020, 2021, 2022, then the Republicans come riding in 2024 and they get all of their power back and they push for another massive tax cut. This is the long game. They don't care. If you don't want this, you're going to get this and you're going to like it.
You know, we get all outraged for a few days over the latest incivility, if you want, coming from Donald Trump, whatever tweet or remark he made about a Gold Star family. And that it's fine. We should note these things and catalog them. But you three have already touched on the central problem here. And that is that Donald Trump is a deeply damaged human being. He is a sociopathic, malignant narcissist. And he happens to be the electoral system, not the American people, but the Electoral College has sort of vomited this thing up.
Okay.
And it landed in the Oval Office, and it needs to be removed. It's a stain. It's a big glob on the carpet there. It needs to be removed, and that means impeachment of the 25th Amendment. This man is a danger to the world.
I used the words stupid and ignorant and all these words that I shouldn't, right? This is really just childish name-calling that I'm engaging in out of frustration, and I'm conscious enough to know that. But what we need to realize is the real long game that's being played right now. The Republicans know what they're doing. They don't care what you want. And they know what they're doing. And they're not going to give a tax cut to you. And they're not going to pay to run ads. Because they know where the money's at. The money is not in your little donation or you buying a $45 MAGA hat. They know where the money is. And the money is in these insanely rich individuals that do not have enough wealth or do not believe that they have enough wealth. But I promise you this, if we can defeat the Republicans on this tax bill, and they must, it passed the House, so we're already too close for comfort. But if we defeat the Republican Party on this tax bill, and the wealthy donors, the people that own the GOP, the handful of wealthy families, the DeVos family and the Koch family and the Mercer family, they've already said to the GOP, hey, if you can't get this tax bill passed, don't come looking to us for any more money. Because those families give up all that money because they want more money. They see it as an investment. Betsy DeVos called it herself. When she became education secretary, she said, the money that I've given over the years is an investment. And now she's come to collect. And now she has a cabinet position job. But if they can't get this bill passed, then they're going to be out of power. And they're not going to have a viable way to get back into power if they don't start listening to people. But they're still in a stage where they don't have to listen to people. And this is where they have to pay. They can't be brought in. They can't win next year's election or the election after, or even lose those elections after passing this tax bill. They need to lose, and they need to lose hard, and they need to hit, as the old saying goes, rock bottom. Because then, at that point, I believe, and I don't think we should get rid of the conservative party, the Republican Party. I think we need the left and the right. I think both play a viable role in the body politic. But the Republican Party is not a viable party right now because they only listen to super wealthy people. And if they lose all of their wealthy donors, they're going to have to start listening to people. And if they start listening to people, whoa, Nelly, who knows how far we can go with this thing? Stay tuned. Thank you for being here on The Fire You Can't Put Out. Our official home is tficpo.podbean.com. We are expanding our social media presence next year, so watch out for that. Like us on Facebook at facebook.com/TFYICPO. You can listen on the go. Just download the Podbean app at the iTunes Store or at the Google Play Store for Android users. Individual episodes are available at the iTunes Store. Just search for The Fire You Can't Put Out there. You can also subscribe so that you never miss an episode. Questions, comments, hate mail, or just a general statement or inquiry, you can email us at TFYICPO@gmail.com. We work hard to not only inform and entertain, but also to keep an open dialogue with our growing listener base. So feel free to reach out to us. Man, sometimes I talk too much. And as always, thank you for listening. We are the fire you can't put out, and we will prevail. Rejecting austerity. It's what it is. It's Republican austerity. Rejecting austerity in favor of prosperity. Special thanks to Kevin for producing, and thank you for listening. This is Melvin signing off. Now that I have woken you up, good morning.